Explanation. Explanation via uncontrollable idealization. So let me start with some assumptions that I'm going to make about explanation in this talk. Some general assumptions. They're not uncontroversial, but I'm just going to start here. Scientific explanation enables us to understand why a phenomenon occurs, almost verbatim from Hempel. Phenomena include behaviors of systems, regularities, similarities among behaviors, and so on. Second, explanation is distinct from confirmation and prediction. So explanation is a singular achievement. Science aims at describing, aims at representing, predicting, and controlling, but it also aims at explanation. So you can have a set of statements that are very detailed, true, accurate, well-confirmed by evidence, provide an excellent description or prediction, yet not be explanatory. Explanations come in varying degrees of goodness or depth. It's not all or nothing. You can have better or worse explanations. Some provide just a little understanding, others a great deal. And finally, explanatory practices are different in different scientific fields, and models of scientific explanation should reflect this. So if this doesn't look good to you, you can get off the bus at this point. And there are really two standard stories about explanation. One holds that explanations are deductive arguments with true premises. Not all arguments are explanations, however, as we've seen. So on the orthodox covering law, deductive nomological approach, some deductive arguments are explanatory because the statements in the explanants, the premises in the argument, include, for example, a relevant scientific law, initial conditions, and some other conditions as well. There is another variant of this type of approach that appeals to unification. So the derivation is explanatory when it falls under a widely used pattern of argumentation. And I think there's something to this. I'll have a speculation about that at the end. And, you know, on this Hempelian approach, explanations show how the phenomenon to be explained is to be expected. The other standard approach holds that explanations give the right kinds of causal or counterfactual stories, a story relevant to the occurrence of the explanandum, the phenomenon to be explained. One thing that both standard approaches agree on is that the statements in the explanants must be true. And that seems pretty darn reasonable. The statements that are reduced to explain should describe the laws, regularities, perhaps causal relations, properties, dependency structures, so on, that actually obtain in the physical system that exhibits the phenomenon to be explained. This paper is going to focus on explanation in physics and limit discussions to deductivist approaches to explanation on the assumption that these kind of approaches are going to be more widely relevant across a range of fields of physics. In many fields, there's no causal story to be told, or if you do tell a causal story, it's really outside the scope of kind of the standard physics. So this idea and some other considerations that we'll hear in this talk are aiming to motivate a deductivist approach, but it's not part of this paper to argue for that kind of approach. That's just where we're starting from. And our starting point is really that virtually all cases of what are taken to be bona fide explanation in physics fail to satisfy even the basic requirements of standard philosophical approaches, namely the truth requirement. And this is because explanation in physics relies essentially on idealizations, idealized models of physical systems. So these explanations contain false statements about both the explanatorily relevant features of the system, the explanants, and also the phenomenon to be explained, the explanandum. So the question is, should we be worried? Well, non-philosophers of science, and maybe even some philosophers of science, are shocked and appalled by this. Without truth, how can you have explanation at all? These explanatory practices have gone horribly wrong. But I suspect that this crowd is not particularly shocked or worried by this, because there's a fairly obvious response, a kind of workaround, which is the topic of the next slide. But the moral of this talk is that the fairly obvious response doesn't work. And maybe we should be a little more worried about explanation than we have been so far. Okay, so here's the argument that I'm going to make today. Some philosophers have claimed that idealizations can be used to underwrite explanation, but only when the idealizations are what have variously been called by various people Galilean approximative, harmless, traditional, and controllable. Mostly by philosophers of physics, except Elliot Sober has a good piece on explanation in the context of evolutionary theory, where he distinguishes harmless from harmful idealizations. So the characterization of what makes an idealization Galilean, et cetera, is pretty generally quite vague, and I'm going to focus here on controllability because it's the least vague of all these criteria. So as I've mentioned, this paper is arguing that this is mistaken. And the argument makes use of a counterexample, so we're going to look briefly at an example of a simple pendulum subject to a quadratic damping force. It's going to be, it's the case that this is clearly an uncontrollable idealization by a clear account of controllability, but it also provides a really good explanation of the behavior of the pendulum. In fact, many kinds of explanations put forward in physics are based on idealizations which clearly fail to meet these conditions. So uncontrollable idealizations can have explanatory capacities, and in a way distinct from Bob's asymptotic explanation. At the very end, I'll have a slide about asymptotic explanation. It's a bit different than what I'm talking about here. More generally, I guess the moral is that I think philosophers of physics have picked a bad strategy for understanding explanation in physics. The bad strategy, because it has things the wrong way around. It's attempting to reduce explanation to some other feature of idealizations, like controllability or harmlessness or whatever. And the better approach, what I'm going to suggest at the end, is to turn it around. You can give an account of controllability in terms of explanation, if you want an account of controllability. Okay, so that's the plan. Section 2, explanation via Galilean idealization. An idealized model is known not to represent accurately some elements of a target system. And there's lots of ways in which models can be idealized. You can leave out elements of the target system via abstraction. You can approximate, simplify elements of the target system. You can have elements in your model which are not present in the system, even elements in your model which are physically impossible. So there are lots of ways idealizations are different from the target system. We'll have some examples shortly. And I think I will say that Galileo was the first to develop this kind of approach to mathematical physics. So he developed a range of idealizing techniques aimed at predicting and explaining natural phenomena. He created what he called, for example, an idealized construct of a simple pendulum. So it's the basic idea that the pendulum is not subject to air resistance, the wire is massless and inelastic, the support is perfectly motionless. And you can contrast that with the real pendulum. And Galileo, not only did he develop models, including models of the pendulum, without really having any mathematics, except for Euclid, I mean, he had ratios, that was it. He also did many years of painstaking work on real pendulum, as well as real free-falling objects and other things, and had quite accurate experimental observations. So, for example, Galileo hypothesized that an ideal pendulum continues to oscillate indefinitely with the same amplitude and period and obeys his pendulum law, which is the period goes as a square root of the length of a string. Of course, no real Galileo well knew that this idealization failed to describe or predict accurately the behavior of any real pendulums, because real pendulums are damped and have other kinds of behavior. But Galileo and generations of physicists since take the idealization to be explanatory. So Galileo had a pendulum law. It applied exactly to his ideal construct. It was perfectly true of the ideal construct. And you can use the pendulum law plus initial conditions to predict and explain the behavior of the ideal construct. Sure, but we're not particularly interested in the behavior of the ideal construct. We want to know about the real physical pendulum. But Galileo took this to be a good explanation of the behavior of real pendulums. Not only do real pendulums behave approximately the way the ideal pendulum behaves, but also we know how to bring the physical pendulum in closer and closer agreement with the idealization. One way to do that would be to use, for example, to be a little ahistorical here, Boyle's air pump, which came 40 years after Galileo. Boyle developed this chamber where he could evacuate some of the air. If you put a pendulum in there, you would have a behavior that was closer to the behavior of the ideal pendulum because you'd have less air resistance. And we can imagine that as more and more air is removed, the dynamics of the pendulum approaches the one of the idealization. And all of this kind of story makes the explanation really good enough for Galileo, good enough for physicists, and it really should be good enough for us. But it's not really good enough for philosophers in the sense that none of the standard philosophical accounts of explanation make sense of this kind of explanatory practice. Okay, so here's the sensible response. First, I think, and maybe best articulated by Erna McMullen, a handful of characteristics pick out idealized models that can underpin scientific explanation, models that he calls Galilean idealizations. And he characterizes these idealizations as having two features. First of all, they approximate their target system. And I'll have a bit more to say about this in a minute, but equally, or maybe even more importantly, in these kind of cases, and this is the point that McMullen emphasized, complementary to the idealization are kind of de-idealizing techniques, reverse engineering techniques for adding back real-world details and kind of eliminating some of these simplifying assumptions. So another feature of Galilean idealizations is they have an intrinsic self-correcting feature such that they can, at least in principle, be brought in ever closer agreement with empirical observations in a theoretically justified, non-ad hoc way. So in the case of the pendulum, I mean, the first thing you'd want to do is probably add in an air resistance term, which Galileo didn't do for the pendulum, but he did for free-falling objects. He did a lot of experiments, developed a kind of, well, developed a linear model of air resistance, and put that into his idealization of a free fall, but you could do the same thing for pendulums. So I think that two posits seem to underlie the idea that Galilean idealizations have explanatory power. First is the idea that I just mentioned, that the idealizations are approximative in these sorts of cases. So explanations based on Galilean idealizations, while strictly speaking they apply only to the idealized model, are not too far off, roughly speaking, when applied to the physical system of interest. And second is the idea, also just mentioned, that it's possible kind of systematically to refine the idealization in a non-ad hoc way. So the statements in the explanation can become, in principle, at least true of the physical system as well. I'm going to call this idea, that this is how idealizations are explanatory, call this strategy explanation via Galilean idealization, or EVGI for short. So the EVGI strategy maintains that explanation as a normative goal of physics can only be achieved in the context of Galilean idealization. So the idea here is that only Galilean idealizations are explanatory, kind of expanding the scope of explanation beyond explanations with true premises. And it's a way to try to make sense of explanatory practice in physics. So let's look at these two features of Galilean idealization in a bit more detail. One feature is that they approximate the target system. And the way this is often put is that Galilean idealizations achieve a kind of common sense representational success. So philosophers of science, at least, are inclined to say, in a kind of naive way, I think this is probably naive for philosophers of language, that some scientific models are just about bits of the world. And then they can do a pretty successful, you know, a good job of representing those bits of the world. Now, what exactly constitutes a successful representation or approximation is kind of a tricky question, but it's got something to do with considerations of similarity between elements of the model and elements of the physical system, at least between the relevant elements. So intuitively, Galileo's pendulum models represent real pendulums successfully because bits of the model are similar to bits of the world. And I think this kind of idea surely reflects kind of common views about representational success. And so in what follows, I'm not going to really make this more precise. I'm just going to use approximation or successful representation to refer to this kind of an idea. Second feature is that Galilean idealizations are controllable. And I think controllability is really the best way to capture what McMullen means here. Larry Sklar had an interesting discussion of controllability, where he says that controllability means either discrepancies between the idealization and the target system are negligible, i.e. approximation, or discrepancies can be subtracted off based on background theory when they're not negligible. So this is, I think, the second sense of controllability that we're interested in. The idea that you can kind of reverse engineer these idealizations incrementally to get arbitrarily close to the perfect model. And I think Bob has expressed this idea very well when he said an idealization is controllable means that it is possible via appeal to theory to compensate in some way for the idealization. I think that really captures what McMullen was aiming at. And since controllability is going to be important, and Bob has written a bit more on it, I'm going to summarize. I mean, the virtue of controllability, as I mentioned, is it's pretty much the only criterion that is actually put in a clear and precise form. Everything else is just too vague to work with. So thank you, Bob, for making this clear enough to refute. Okay, so an idealization involving an infinite limit is uncontrollable, Bob says, when the limit is singular and the behavior at the limit is qualitatively different from the pre-limit behavior. So that's a kind of concrete way to put this idea. And as most of you or all of you already know, Bob's focus is on physical systems where approximation schemes for a kind of base level or more fundamental theory break down, including statistical mechanical models of criticality, breakdown of the wave theory of light in catastrophe optics, drop formation in hydrodynamics, and a couple of other examples as well. So as Bob says in the book, in his book, in these cases, presence of a singular limit results in the unexplainability of the upper-level behavior in base-level terms. So this is one of the key ideas of his 2002 book and leads to a discussion of emergence as a consequence of that unexplainability, right? In some of these cases, the phenomena are emergent. Okay, and I'll just flag it that Bob has another idea about explanation called asymptotic explanation, which is how things are supposed to work in these cases, and I will table that for now and get back to it at the end. So not only is this pretty clear and precise, but it also seems to be the right notion for our approach to explanation. You know, explanations are arguments on the approach I'm taking, and you know, they're deductive arguments. You derive the explanandum from the explanants. And a controllable derivation is going to be one where the limiting procedure is regular, which means we can derive the result, the explanandum, deductively from the premises, the explanant. So it seems to kind of fit the notion of explanation that we want. I think it's also worth mentioning kind of as an aside that there are related ideas of controllability out there. I'm thinking in particular the idea of controllability as mathematical computability, and there's a group, the IHPST group in Paris, which has done quite a bit of work on that. Cyril Imbert and Anouk Barbarous. And I think they'll have some results soon. Okay, so just to remind you again, I'm going to say ultimately that this controllability criterion is not going to be helpful. And in fact, the whole FD strategy ought to be rejected. That's actually the main point of the talk. But before we get there, let's just try to sum up Evgi in terms of two conditions. So Evgi maintains there's a significant difference between Galilean idealizations and other types. Only the former under right explanation. So in the context of a deductivist approach to explanation, I think we can sum up the characteristics of Galilean idealization just sketched in terms of the following two conditions. There's a condition on the exponents that the premises in the exponents are true of the idealization and approximately true of the target system, and the idealization is controllable. And an exponentative condition, the conclusion derived from the exponents approximates the actual exponentative statement. So both conditions, as I mentioned, are based on this intuition that statements figuring in successful explanations describe elements of an idealization you'd normally want to say are successfully represent or are about features of the target system. And the Evgi strategy maintains that explanation as a normative goal of physics can only be achieved in the context of Galilean, approximative, controllable, etc. idealization. Section 3, challenge from uncontrollable idealization. Okay, the trouble is that Galilean idealizations are far more pervasive in philosophical accounts of physics than they are, of course, in physics itself. A large part of the putative explanatory practice in physics just doesn't fit this Evgi strategy. And these are explanations based on what I'll call non-Galilean idealizations. Putatively explanatorily relevant elements of the model do not approximate or successfully represent the physical system, and the explanation involves both singular limits and qualitatively novel phenomena. So this is the case where the exponents condition is violated. Let me give you an example. It's a modification of Galileo's idealized construct of the pendulum. I mean, as I mentioned, the first correction you'd probably want to make is to add in an air resistance term for the bob. We're still dealing with an idealized model, right? Massless, inelastic wire, motionless support, and so on. And as I mentioned, Galileo had a linear model of air resistance. But for real kind of tabletop pendulums, well, Galileo's pendulums range between tabletop size and then the one, the two-story one that he had out his balcony at University of Padua, shielded from the wind. For these kind of pendulums, the damping effect of air resistance isn't actually linear, it's quadratic. And the equation of motion must include approximately quadratic viscous damping due to air resistance on the bob. And the governing equation is this one, where theta is the angle of the bob, epsilon is a small parameter related to the strength of the damping, mega naught's the initial frequency. Now, if you apply regular perturbation methods to a small but finite amplitude motion, you will get bad results. You'll have secular terms that grow as positive powers of t, which is not good, and you'll have a divergent series expansion where terms in the series will grow, so the ratio of the third term to the second term is unbounded. So you need to use asymptotic methods to obtain a uniformly valid approximate solution. I'm not going to provide the solution here. There's several textbooks you can find it in. But I'm going to provide an overview of it. So I think the starting point here is a phenomenology of the behavior at small finite amplitudes. So what you'll notice if you looked at the pendulum is that you have approximately simple harmonic oscillation. And so you could model it at least over a short time scale. You could start off with a simple harmonic oscillator. And normally, in a case like this, as simple as this, you wouldn't probably be talking in terms of models. You just work directly with the equations. But I'm going to continue to speak in terms of models and idealizations, because that's the way these problems are treated when they get more complex. So we have that. We also have the governing equation, which you just saw, and initial conditions. And then you could add in your observed kind of long-term constraints on the behavior, which I'm calling additional assumptions. So you've got approximately periodic behavior with slowly varying amplitude and frequency. If they vary at all, they're going to vary slowly. So no secular terms. Then you can use singular perturbation techniques. And there's a whole range of different mathematical techniques that you can use here. You can use Lindstedt-Poincaré method, where you replace the time variable with a new time variable, tau, which is omega times t. That would work. You need a way to have the solution encompass a dependence of the frequency on the amplitude, which is what the regular perturbation techniques can't do. So you've got that. You also can use a method of multiple scales where you have a bunch of different independent, well, typically time scales. That's what you would use in this case. Or you can use a kind of averaging method like the KBM method. And the reason I'm mentioning that there's a bunch of different methods is that in the past, some philosophers of physics have tended to reify the mathematics a bit too much. Not Bob, but actually Alex Ruger, who's done a similar kind of thing. Well, not Bob in this case. I'm not making a general statement here. But Alex Ruger, who's treated the same kinds of cases, I think the problem there with him and a few others is that they took the multi-scale expansion and reified, you know, the two independent time scales, T and epsilon T. And suddenly the idea is that, or the claim is that there's two different ontological levels here. But that's over-reification of the math in this case, because you can get the same result using lots of different kinds of techniques. Yeah.
The governing equation is the one you just put up.
Yeah.
Right, which is not the equation for a simple harmonic oscillator. So what is it? I'm just not sure how to understand this, the claim that you're starting somehow with the harmonic oscillator. What is
it? Yeah, maybe this wasn't clear. So the idea is that the method is a perturbation on the simple harmonic oscillator. So you start with a simple harmonic oscillator, and you look at the effect of the air resistance as a perturbation on that.
Well, the governing equation.
Yeah. No, the governing equation isn't given by that, but you do a perturbation on the simple harmonic oscillator. I guess, yeah, to try to approximate the governing equation.
You mean
so, for example,
solution. I mean, isn't the idea you start with periodic behavior,
yeah,
and then you perturb that?
Yeah.
By
exactly.
Putting in time varying amplitudes and frequency, and then get an equation for the amplitude and frequency.
Right. Right. And you use the constraints. For example, no secular terms. So you can eliminate secular terms that way.
Yeah. What are secular terms?
Terms that grow without bound, like a t to the n sine beta,
right,
or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, it's probably not that important for your deal model.
Well,
confuses what.
I'll have another take on this, and then we'll come back to it at the end if it's going to be relevant. And the result, for example, the second order in epsilon is an accurate approximate model of the long time scale behavior. So you get a pretty darn accurate picture of the long time scale behavior of this pendulum compared with, let's say, a numerical simulation or compared with what you can observe. Okay, so what we have here is a derivation, a kind of standard derivation of an approximation, a close approximation of the pendulum behavior with quadratic n. You've got a derivation. But my claim is that this is also not just a derivation, it's also an explanation, a pretty good explanation on the, you know, scale of explanation. So let's look at this putative explanation a bit more closely. I mean, what you've got in the explanants, the premises in the explanation, are the governing equation, the initial conditions, some statements about the simple harmonic oscillator idealization. You've got some additional assumptions about there not being any secular terms. It's approximately periodic, slowly varying amplitude and phase, if at all. And you've got some asymptotic mathematical methods, maybe some inference rules, maybe some more assumptions about convergence of these asymptotic series, because you have to also make a few assumptions about how the series converge. Okay, so the idea is this seems to be not just a derivation of the behavior, but an explanation. I'm going to say a few things about why I think it's an explanation in a minute. That's the explanant side of things. Now, on the explanandum side, what are you explaining? Well, it's pretty straightforward. You're explaining an accurate, the end result is a description of, I should say, strictly speaking, statements about an idealized model of the long time scale behavior, which we can represent on the in a phase diagram like this. So you've got a diagram, you've got the oscillation variable and its time derivative, and the lines show you sample trajectories in phase space. So where you have these singular points, oh, I think I have a pointer here. Yes, these singular points are unstable equilibria, and these ones are stable equilibria, the standard kind of phase space description. And what you have pictured here is a quantitative account of the behavior of the pendulum. And just for interest, you can contrast that with the undamped pendulum at small finite amplitude. So the behavior's a little bit different. For one thing, these singularities separate out the kind of unbounded trajectories, where the thing just keeps going round and round and round, from the bounded ones where they oscillate, which is not true in the damped one. So the idealization is uncontrollable. And the idealization I'm referring to here is the derived model of the explanandum, the phenomenon that we're trying to explain. And it's because the limit involved in deriving the idealization is singular, as we've seen. And we've also seen that the behavior at the limit is qualitatively different from the pre-limit behavior. And as we know, singular limit precludes deductive derivation of the behavior from the governing equation in initial conditions alone. So it seems to be kind of a paradigm case of an uncontrollable idealization. The Evgi explanans condition fails, which precludes the derivation being explanatory on the Evgi strategy. Okay, just because of that controllability, failure, uncontrollability. Section 4. Now I think we should reconsider controllability and explanation and all that stuff. And that's what I'm going to start to do here. Yeah.
The explanandum is a model, as an accurate model, as opposed to the phenomena.
The explanandum, in this case, is a set of statements.
Right.
Ductivist approach. Yeah.
Right.
It's a set of statements that describe. Well, yeah. Maybe I wasn't quite clear on this. So it describes both an idealized model representing a phase-based portrait, and also describes approximately the actual observed behavior.
Mm-hmm. Which I would have thought would be the thing trying to explain.
Yes.
The behavior.
Yeah.
Not the model.
Yes, you're trying to explain the behavior. And you do that by deriving facts about an idealized model which approximates the behavior. So that's kind of, that's exactly the exponendum condition, and it's perfectly satisfied here. By whatever means, you've derived a set of statements which are exactly true of an idealized model and approximately true of the actual pendulum, tabletop pendulum.
You're calling that an approximate explanation? Is that what the...
Well, I'm just calling it an explanation. I'm not calling it an approximate explanation. It's, I mean, on the FP strategy, it's an explanation. If the statement derived from the exponents, the statements, approximate the actual statement about the exponentum statement, the actual statement about the behavior, that's an explanation. It's not an approximate explanation. It's not a temporary explanation or a pseudo-explanation. It's just an explanation. That's McMullen's strategy, not just McMullen, but many others.
But you're accepting that aspect of that's his partner deductive paradox.
Yes. I'm accepting that aspect of it. Yeah, very good. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the assumption. Otherwise, just a little aside here, I mean, if you don't like that, then go with the standard philosophical line, which I would call, although I didn't put the slide in here because it was too long already, the reactionary option. You just go, you know, there's a big difference between some facts about the extension of the term explanation as used by physicists, you know, how they apply the term, and a normative account of explanation. They're independent, they've got nothing to do with each other, and just stick to philosophy. Right? You can take that one. You can maintain truth as a criterion.
And what about a third option?
There is no third option. You can be a reactionary, or you can go with it.
You have until the end of the talk to come up with this.
Yeah. I shouldn't say that. If you give me a third option, I'd be delighted. Okay, so let's just think about this for a few more minutes. So I think the explanation has, I think this derivation has some explanatory merits. Why do I think so? Well, why isn't this just a prediction of the behavior? Well, I don't have a theory of explanation to back this up. I'm not even sure that's the right approach, but I am going to make some observations about this derivation. First of all, the governing equation applies to all nonlinear oscillators with quadratic viscous damping, and it's of a form applicable to nonlinear systems more generally. I mean, applicable to nonlinear periodic systems and, you know, also of a form applicable to nonlinear systems more generally. So if you have a periodic system with a driving and a damping term, you're going to get an equation of that form where the middle term is going to be some differentiable function of the oscillation variable. And that's going to do you for pretty much, I think, for any periodic nonlinear system. So that's one observation. Second observation is that the assumptions used in the derivation are very weak. Right? We had to introduce some additional assumptions. It wasn't just a deduction from the governing equation plus initial conditions. But think about the assumptions we introduced. They were pretty weak, and they were also completely characterizable in base level terms. They don't the assumptions aren't kind of, they don't follow from the governing equation, but they can be characterized in exactly the terms of they're just about the periodicity. The assumptions are also effective, these exactly the same assumptions, in deriving the behavior of many other types of nonlinear systems. I mean, those specific assumptions work in a broad range of periodic systems. Okay, so maybe just to say one more thing, and I'll come back to this. When I say that they're base-level assumptions, I mean that they're assumptions about the short time scale periodic behavior. You're not making some wild assumption like about the limit cycle or about the form of the singularities or about something entirely different. You're making an assumption about the short time scale behavior. And finally, I would observe that these kinds of asymptotic methods are incredibly effective in a wide range of systems. Okay, I haven't really demonstrated that here, but that's my claim. So I think we should reconsider controllability. First of all, idealizations involving singular limits and qualitatively new phenomena can be explanatory. So I think actually Bob's account of controllability maybe didn't capture entirely what might be useful in that notion or what even Sklar was thinking about. Because Sklar also said the uncontrollable cases are those, quote, where the choice of the appropriate limit is not fixed in any obvious way by our embedding background theory. Now, it's not entirely clear. I'm not exactly sure what he means by embedding background theory. But I think what he means is that somehow the appropriate limit is not fixed in any way by the theory and connected or relevant base level theories or assumptions, right? So it's not, they're not fixed by the governing equation or the initial conditions or even other facts about that base level characterization. So I think Sklar is really allowing that singular limit cases and qualitatively novel cases could be controllable. It's not really the mathematical limit that matters here, but rather the assumptions, the other information that's brought to bear when that mathematical, when the idealization breaks down, when you use asymptotic methods. So if these additional assumptions are sufficiently weak and sufficiently connected with your characterization of the system at the base level, then maybe you have controllability. And as we've seen, that's the case here. You've also got... So I think you want to call these kinds of cases controllable. And I think you want to maybe replace Bob's suggestion with something like controllable idealizations are ones in which the assumptions involved are sufficiently weak and justified in the context of base level theory, the additional assumptions you have to make after the breakdown of regular perturbation methods. Contrast with uncontrollable idealizations where you have to make stronger assumptions, ones that may be ad hoc or assumptions that are not really related to or justified by your characterization of the system. So in other words, since this is exactly how you would want to characterize explanation, controllable idealizations are those that are explanatory. Precisely the features that make that derivation explanatory, maybe you'd want to say, well, that idealization is controllable. So what I'm suggesting is, there's two choices. You can either just drop talk of controllability in favor of explanation, or if you do want to have a notion of controllability or Galilean or harmlessness or something, you don't have some sort of independent criterion, and then you apply it to show whether the idealization is explanatory. You rather have those follow from whether the idealization is explanatory. So explanatoriness, I guess, is the base notion. And there's no kind of independent criterion there. That's basically what's wrong with the Evge strategy, as you probably guessed. So explanations are put forward that fail to meet the requirements of the Evge strategy, and particularly its explanans condition, controllability. The Evge assumption, I think, that the normative goal of explanation can only be achieved in the context of Galilean idealization should be rejected. Rather, you might say something like, let's characterize Galilean idealizations are those that are explanatory, that underwrite or have explanatory capacities, underwrite explanations. And what makes some idealizations explanatory? Well, it has to do with the features that we've observed, which I'll have something to say about in a minute. So maybe drop the notion of Galilean controllable and so on in favor of explanatory. Okay, I promised to say something about asymptotic explanation. Bob and others, I'm thinking of Elisa Bokulich's book on semiclassical mechanics, have made other kinds of claims of that highly idealized models can have explanatory power or capacities. So you can recall that for Bob, unexplainability of the behavior in base level terms results is the result of a presence of a singular limit in the idealizing process. But he also has a notion of asymptotic explanation, and that's the explanation of the universality of behavior in upper level terms using asymptotic mathematical techniques. So here, I think Bob is interested in phenomena that are structurally stable, that they appear in the same form, either in the same system under perturbation, or they appear in the same form in quite diverse realizers, diverse kinds of systems. And this is, I think, what universality means. So these structural features are revealed in analysis where you systematically eliminate the base level details. And I think the explanandum here for these asymptotic explanations is different from the kinds of cases that I've looked at, from the nonlinear oscillator case. Rather than explain a feature of a specific system, like the phase-space portrait of that particular oscillator, what you're explaining is a regularity or the stability of a regularity across different systems. So you're explaining a regularity, maybe not a behavior in a specific system. And I think the explanans is different as well. And this is characterized maybe best with an example. You're probably familiar with Bob's rainbow example. Rainbows are described in the asymptotic limit of wave optics in some regime where the wavelength goes to zero. And the theory of rainbows uses imports, geometrical optics, which is kind of an upper-level theory. And in this boundary regime where the base-level theory breaks down, it's only characterizable in these upper-level terms, geometrical terms. So in the rainbow case, setting up the specific initial and boundary conditions that correspond to this limit and that correspond to the phenomenon you're trying to explain here, the rainbow, ineliminably, this is Bob's claim, ineliminably involves reference to concepts of geometrical optics, concepts you've imported from a different theory. And this goes beyond the kind of base level explanatory resources. That's Bob's idea. So in these kind of asymptotic explanations, the explanans includes ineliminably some distinct theory, some upper level theoretical resources that you've imported in. And maybe you've just brought them in for that particular case. It could be kind of an ad hoc thing, or maybe it works in a variety of cases. But it's something that's distinct from the base level theory. So that's the kind of contrast I want to draw with the pendulum case, where there the additional assumptions you have to bring when you have the breakdown of the regular perturbation scheme, those additional assumptions are, in a sense, putting this pretty roughly, but basically they're not from the outside. They're characterizable in base level terms. They're tightly knit with or related to the base level theory. That's the kind of contrast. Asymptotic explanation enables idealized models to explain universal features in cases where these features are not explained at a more basic level. So the main idea here is that I think asymptotic explanation is a different kind of explanation from what I've been talking about here. Different explanants, different explanandum. And, you might worry, as some people have, and as I do myself, about whether these derivations in these asymptotic explanations are really explanatory at all. I mean, have you really explained or have you just derived some of these features? And that's topic of another talk. Okay, conclusion. So let's just sum up. The orthodox view in philosophy of physics that only Galilean approximate of harmless, traditional, or controllable idealizations can underwrite explanation is mistaken, in the way I've tried to explain, in the sense that these are not independent criteria for when idealizations can do work in explanation. What have been characterized as uncontrollable idealizations can have explanatory capacities. And I think this is perhaps a bad strategy for understanding explanation in physics. Now, you'll notice so far, and I've just got a few more minutes, I have not actually outlined a better strategy for understanding explanation in physics. And that, again, has to be the topic of another talk. But I have a few ideas about how such a strategy would go. Certain idealizations in physics feature essentially in derivations of phenomena that are explanatory. And we've seen some of these kind of characteristics, right? You have a governing equation that's widely applicable. You make use of a simple, again, kind of widely applicable base level model. You have some common assumptions. You have mathematical asymptotic techniques that are effective in a wide range of systems and so on. These are some of the characteristics. And these are the idealizations that enable us to understand why a phenomenon occurs, at least in part. and they may not be controllable. I think an adequate account of explanation in physics will be deductivist, as I've said, a kind of covering law type account. So it's going to be kind of covering law plus, right? Or covering law type plus. And the question is, what's the plus? Well, I'll take 2 minutes to give you some ideas about the plus. Well, let's start with Duhem. He had a great take on Galileo. He said Galileo's great achievement was not to approximate reality, but to save all the phenomena in exactly the same way, right? This is Duhem's idea, is that Galileo and Kepler, for that matter, misunderstood what they were up to, right? Galileo thought that, thinking in the context, this is in the context of astronomy, his regularities are at least approximately describe the true laws of nature governing the behavior of celestial phenomena. And Duhem thought this was entirely wrong, right? He thought this was harmful, what else did he say? Illogical, false, so on, right? He thought it's much better understood that a theory of celestial motion can rest on the same kind of basis that supports a theory of terrestrial motion, right? All motions are saved by one and the same set of postulates. And the postulates are in the language of mathematics. And this, you know, Duhem's big idea is that they were preparing for Newton in this way, right? So Duhem's idea is that the hypotheses of physics are mere mathematical contrivances designed for the purpose of saving the phenomena. And their great virtue, explanatory virtue, is when they save all the phenomena together. So you will not be surprised that it seems to me that something to do with explanatory unification is going to be relevant to a theory of explanation, right? I mean, just intuitively, theory unification with the field of science has to do with demonstrating connections between phenomena. So does explanation. They seem kind of similar, phenomena that were hitherto thought to be unrelated. But, of course, making a connection between unification and explanation, making that precise is, I think it has not been done successfully so far. In part because explanation is a heterogeneous thing, it can be quite different, take different forms in different fields of physics and different sciences, and unification is also heterogeneous. There's different kinds of unification. Kitcher had an idea about this, in the context of the DN model. Explanations are arguments that, among other conditions, are appropriately connected to a larger pattern of argumentation within a field of science. Derivation of the behavior, for example, of the quadratically damped simple pendulum is explanatory in part because it's part of a unified pattern of such derivations. Explanations via idealization exhibit a derivational parsimony, where one or a small number of argument patterns are used in a broad range of derivations. So that's all speculation. Let me just end by saying that the moral of this paper is that the scope of explanatory idealization should be expanded. And what we need to do first is we need more detailed work on cases in physics in which these putative explanations are developed, obviously. And we also need a normative account that makes sense of explanation in the context of idealization in physics. Thank you.
Thank you. This is very interesting. I want to get clearer about the role of these additional assumptions in the explanation. So it's important for your point that we're not getting the behavior to be explained from the governing equation and initial conditions alone.
Right.
There are additional assumptions with your absence of secular terms and slowly they can be approximated over short time periods by simple harmonic oscillation, yeah. And then there's slowly varying amplitude and frequency. Now, are there any solutions to the governing equation that don't have those features? Are there solutions to the governing equation that have secular terms in them?
Yes. Yeah.
So you're actually by those assumptions, narrowing down the class of solutions.
Absolutely. Taylor series expansion, you know, with of the...
Well, I'm not asking whether Taylor series converges. I'm asking is, do those solutions act... So, if you go back to the phase space diagram...
Yeah. Might take a while.
Right.
Just a second. Probably a better way to do this.
Right.
That's right. It's a nice reminder.
Pucks make sense backwards, too.
Right.
Oh, there we go.
Okay. So as long as I'm not at one of those singular points, if I specify initial conditions, then that uniquely determines the solution, right?
Right.
Okay. And that solution satisfies those additional considerations.
Right, but that's not a solution of the governing equation. It's a solution, in this case, of a second-order approximation.
What would the phase portrait of solutions of the governing equation look like? Wouldn't it look just like that?
No. That's a good question, though. Okay, what would you have? You'd have these...
Because I took those were actually the...
No, you'd have something crazy because, you know, the Taylor series blows up and you'd have...
I don't care about the Taylor series. The Taylor series might not converge. That's fine. What I'm saying is, look at this differential equation. What does the class of solutions to that differential equation
look like? Okay, well, I mean, how about this? Let me try this. So a first-order solution would look like the one on the right?
No.
And the second order would look like...
What are the solutions? Maybe I'm using the wrong word. Okay, so there's you've got this equation, and there are trajectories through phase space which satisfy that equation, right?
I'm not sure.
I
can tell you the first order.
It's not true. The usual existence and uniqueness theorems apply. So for most initial conditions, there will be a unique solution.
Okay.
Okay.
You know that, or do you just?
I don't know that.
For that equation.
Okay.
I don't know that. So, I mean, beyond kind of the regular perturbation, first order solution I can tell you, second order solution I can tell you, asymptotic methods I can tell you, the second order.
Yeah, so you're talking about methods. Okay. Take your attention momentarily away from methods that are arriving at solutions. Okay. And there's a mathematical question about this equation.
Okay.
Namely, what are the trajectories to phase space that such that this is satisfied at every point in that trajectory?
Okay.
And so the question is whether all of those trajectories satisfy those additional constraints, or whether there are in fact trajectories that satisfy that equation at all points and, you know, are unbounded. And I suspect that there aren't.
Okay.
And it's really important for your case, because you may, if in fact all solutions of that equation also satisfy those additional requirements, then those additional requirements aren't excluding anything from the space of solutions, and in fact are entailed by the governing equation, whether or not we personally have derived them from the governing equation. Right?
Yep.
And so one possibility is that, which I suspect is correct, is that they are in fact entailed by the governing equation, though in in constructing the solutions, we have not derived them from the governing equation.
Okay.
And if that's true, then what you don't want to say is that the assumptions don't follow from the governing equation, because they in fact do, but that we bring in those assumptions without deriving them from the governing equation. And that's an important distinction, because I think you've put your finger on something very interesting and important, but I don't think it has the consequences about explanation that you want it to. One thing that we often do in physics is give an equation, you make an ansatz about the form of the solution, and you have it, and that's a guess. You haven't derived that from the equation.
Right.
And then working with that, you actually show that all solutions to the equation satisfy that ansatz.
Mm-hmm.
And what you've actually done is you have derived, you actually have derived the solutions of the equation deductively, but you've used a deductive strategy that's very different from the patterns of argumentation that philosophers tend to talk about. And I think that that's very interesting. But it's not a case where you haven't actually derived the solution from the equation. What you've done is sort of done a roundabout strategy that involves a guess that you couldn't necessarily program the computer to do.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah. No, that raises a really interesting question.
Because if you want to say that if you want to say that it doesn't fall from the governing equation that there are no secular terms, you're saying that the governing equation has some unbounded solutions, and certainly you haven't shown that.
Right. Yeah. No. Yeah. Thank you for that point. And it raises a really interesting question, which is, what does whether or not the governing equation have unbounded solutions, is that relevant for the point about explanation at all? Right? Because
if it's relevant for you, if it's important for you that those assumptions don't follow from the governing equation, then yes, it is.
But I think maybe it's important for me that the explanation requires those assumptions. Because I'm not talking about kind of intrinsic explanations or ideal explanatory texts.
This is an important point, because what does it mean to say the explanation requires those assumptions? One thing it could mean is there could be no explanation without those assumptions. And another thing it could mean is, well, even if there could be, even if someone were smart enough to do the derivation without those assumptions, it would be a different explanation. And, which do you mean?
I really not want to say something as strong as there could be no explanation without those assumptions.
Right.
That raises interesting questions, and not something that I really focused on here.
Right.
But what I do want to say is that the explanation in the context of what? The current physics makes use of those assumptions.
Right.
And no derivation which doesn't have those assumptions is an explanation. Now whether one, maybe there could be one in the context of, and I'm not sure, it would depend on what that context was, context of a different set of mathematical techniques, I'm not quite sure how that would work. But I guess all I need to claim here is that the explanations in the context of current physics do make use of those assumptions. But it's a good...
I'm not convinced that if you actually look at the... if you actually look at the derivation in detail, I'm not convinced that if you haven't... at the end of the day, what you haven't shown... that you haven't shown that the assumptions actually do follow from the governing equation.
Well, if you look at the derivation in detail, you see the assumptions are explicitly brought in.
Right, that's right. So that's what I'm saying. Sometimes we do that.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
There are cases in which we bring in an ansatz, and then working with not having derived it from the equation, and then working with that, show that all solutions satisfy the ansatz. And in that case, what we have shown is the ansatz actually follows from the equation, even though in the process of getting that conclusion, we brought it in from outside.
Right. Okay, so that's not the explanations that I've been looking at.
not ones where that have that final step of eliminating the outsize. Now, whether you could have an explanation that, that has that final step, it's an interesting question. Yeah. Bob.
So, I have lots of questions and remarks, obviously, but with respect to these assumptions, you stated that they were rather weak assumptions, innocuous assumptions, the non-existence of secular terms, the convergence of the series expansion.
Can you speak up just a little bit?
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
He said that these are weak assumptions, and that's and if you make those assumptions, then you get some sort of what you would call controllable explanation, right?
Yeah.
But those assumptions are not weak at all. Those are really, really strong assumptions, and in fact, they're false for most of the systems, right? The fact that there are no secular terms is just false for many classical systems. So the assumptions, they don't follow from the equation of motion at all.
Right.
I mean, in fact, yeah. The negation of them usually follow from the equation of motion. So I just don't see, you built into your, what you count as explanatory, the very idea that the thing has to be controllable by somehow introducing these not weak assumptions, which guarantee you that there's controllability and no blow-ups in the right way.
Right.
So those assumptions are, but I'm just repeating myself, they're not weak at all. I wonder whether you just beg the question, right? The whole point was to argue that we need a notion of explanation that gives us some idea about controllability, but when you add those assumptions,
you just
stood it on its head.
Yeah, okay. I'm not sure whether weakness is really the concept I should be focusing on here.
Well, but they're in fact incompatible, by and large, with most of the equations that you're going to start with.
Well, they're not incompatible with a study of periodic...
So write down the equations for the solar system. Right? Any n-body problem is going to have secular terms. That's just the problem.
Yeah.
And to say that they don't exist is just to deny what follows from the equations.
Yeah. I guess I'm thinking in the context of treating these kinds of systems. Let's say nonlinear systems with driving and damping.
Yeah, but those are going to be chaotic and they're going to...
Yeah,
right, they're going to, that's exactly the point. There are going to be regions if you have forcing as well, driving, that phase portrait's gonna look totally different.
Right. I mean, there are systems with driving and damping, weak driving and damping that are periodic. They're chaotic and they're also
Have their KAM systems,
yeah.
Right? So they have solutions which are sets of solutions which are confined to Fourier, and others that wander all over the phase space. And those are the ones that are driven by that's because of these the denial of those assumptions that you're making.
Yeah. Okay, let me try to put this a bit differently and see if this is convincing for you. In the context of explaining features of periodic systems, nonlinear periodic systems. Okay, so let's say you're interested in pendulums, or you're interested in certain kinds of circuits, or certain kinds of the human heart, certain kinds of driven damp systems in the periodic.
So, what do you mean by periodic? That's not periodic.
Well, approximately periodic. Yeah, that's what I mean.
Sorry.
Yeah. So you're interested in explaining the behavior of these approximately periodic systems. In those contexts, the assumption that you make in this case, the same assumption works in all the other cases.
Yeah, but it's still incompatible with the... I mean, if you want to hold a deductive sort of point of view, right, then you can't have assumptions that play an essential role in your argument that are incompatible with other assumptions that play a role in your argument. Why I think that...
Okay, so what's the incompatibility between the governing equation and the...
And the assumption.
And the assumption, yeah.
The functions are false. Of them are. For almost any non-idealized pendulum, that's just false.
Okay, so you start with a governing equation and maybe a simple unperturbed model, like a simple harmonic oscillator, and the end result is that, right? Which is a pretty accurate derivation of the behavior of the system you're interested in. And along the way, there's a derivation that you do, and it's a derivation which involves making some assumptions, which I suppose, I mean, what you do is you replace the governing equation with some sort of expansion.
Right.
You make the assumptions, you limit the scope of the expansion, and then you...
Right, so this is why I'm kind of confused, because on a Galilean strategy, you've got... One way I like to think about the difference between Galilean and non-Galilean idealizations is in terms of sort of series expansions.
Exactly.
Right. And not in terms of their deductive stories or whatever.
Yeah.
So I have a nice simple pendulum. I've got my idealized solution, and I add a little friction term. Well, that's sort of like saying, well, I can de-idealize by adding powers of, by having an expansion in which the first term is the idealized pendulum, and the
right.
second term has these corrections and various powers of
yeah.
whatever you're interested in. So the lovely case is thinking of the relationship between special relativity and Newtonian space and time for like a momentum formula, starting with the classical case and then adding powers and corrections and powers of E over C squared. So there is really nice, and there your assumptions mm-hmm. follow directly
right.
because there's a nice controllable idealization.
Yeah.
But now you want to say that, no, I want to look at systems which are where the idealizations
right.
are, where there are singularities in a certain sense, right?
Right?
Yeah. But then I would think, well, those are situations in which you don't get nice convergent expansions.
That's
in
right.
that way,
right.
But in order for you to have an explanation, you seem to be saying, well, even in these sort of what I would call singular cases or uncontrollable cases, I'm going to assume that there don't exist any secular terms and everything converges. And therefore I can have an explanation. And I just don't understand the motivation for that.
For calling this derivation explanatory?
Yeah, I mean,
okay.
Again, you're just, it's a matter of fact. It's not you can't think of it as a nice convergent series
right.
expansion.
Right.
Right. And
okay.
But you're saying I have to consider it as a nice convergent series expansion. That's what those assumptions are.
Yeah, I'm saying you can make the assumption that it's a nice convergent series expansion. In this case, you can make that assumption in lots of other cases of this kind, and that's in part what makes the derivation explanatory. I mean, there's two worries that you have here. I mean, one might be about the deductive nature of the derivation.
That's one worry. I think
right.
it's a mistake to
right.
think in those terms in the first place. But the other worry is that, well, I mean,
So for deductivism, I mean, maybe we have. Yeah, maybe deductivism needs to be broadened. Maybe we don't just need to add something to deductive nomological, we need to also take something away. So you can have a broader class of derivations, some which are not deductive, that would be explanatory. I'd certainly be comfortable with that kind of a change, because it would fit the kind of point I'm trying to make here about broadening the scope of explanatory derivations.
Sure, well, if you accept like our normalization loop explanations for critical.
Yeah.
Then those are not deductive.
Right, yeah, yeah. I'm not sure I accept them, but I'm willing to accept non-deductive derivations. So it'll be further modification of deductivism. So there's that. And then there's the question about whether these assumptions are, I mean, I said weak and I said kind of broadly effective or useful in a bunch of different kinds of derivations. Not that you have to make an ad hoc different kind of assumption in each case. So that, and I said that had something to do with explanation. Now, maybe, I didn't explain what I meant by characterizing it as weak, and maybe
so
you're right that it's not
weak. It's just simply that, on a deductive view, your exponents are contradictory.
Right. Yeah.
So, and in fact, the assumptions, your weak assumptions, are false. So, why?
Well, the false...
Well, there are secular terms, and various theories don't that converge.
Well,
they're
strong assumptions.
They're false.
Yeah, but you might want to say that they are effective in these kinds of approximately periodic systems, where the behavior of the pendulum doesn't, right, show any secular. It's not, you know,
sure.
Amplitude doesn't grow without bound or anything like that.
Right, but I don't need to buy
Yeah, okay. No, but I think, I mean, there's two two good points there. One is about how to characterize these derivations. Maybe deductivism is too simple and too narrow for what we want. I'm not sure about that, because you can perhaps modify the premises to make it deductive. You can always do that. Not include the governing equation, but some modification of it in the explanation. So there's deductivism, which I'm willing to think about. And then there's, what I do want to say is that the assumptions that you use here have a certain character, maybe weakness is not quite what I wanted to say about them, a certain kind of broad applicability, a certain kind of fact that they're assumptions about the base level, they're characterizable at the kind of short time scale, that makes this kind of a derivation explanatory, where a similar derivation where you had to bring in an assumption that had nothing to do with the initial characterization of the system. It was maybe ad hoc, or maybe it was quite heterogeneous. In some of your cases, like the rainbow case, where you really make, you know, a convincing argument in a lot of these cases that you're bringing in assumptions that are quite different from the base level theory. Geometrical optics, let's say. That those are two different kinds of cases. So the explanatory merits of this kind of a derivation has to do with something about the characterization of the assumptions that you're bringing in. Maybe it's their effectiveness.
I take part of objection to be a very simple worry. You're kind of, I don't know if you're explaining it or over-explaining it, but if you have contradictory assumptions, you can derive anything.
Right.
It's trivial. You trivialize the whole deductive model. So how could this possibly... So the fact that you think you have the exponent doesn't mean anything. If you have, you know, premises 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 are not mutually consistent.
Yeah.
Surprising that you can derive
something. Right. So there's two possible.
So how would you? I'm not understanding you. I think you understand this. I'm not understanding your response.
Okay, my response is, there's two ways you could go. You could say, okay, the DN model of explanation took a narrow view about the kinds of derivations that feature in good explanations. That in lots of cases, like these kind of cases, maybe in biology, other cases, you're going to have derivations where the explanandum doesn't follow deductively from the premises. And you've got some kind of amplitude inference, some kind of...
But here it does follow deductively, but it's trivial.
Right.
Okay.
So maybe we need to... So one strategy would be to recharacterize this, not as a deductive inference, but to have some sort of other kind of explanatory inference that we would... amplitude inference. Okay? A second strategy would be to fix it up so that it is deductive, so you didn't have inconsistent premises. By replacing, for instance, the governing equation with some... and that's actually what happens in the process of deriving the result, is you take the governing equation and you take some expansion and you replace it with another equation, which is distinct from the governing equation, which meets some constraints and which enables you to derive the solution. So maybe you want to start off with that other equation as part of the explanation. Right? You can make it deductive in that way.
By removing the governing equation.
Yeah.
Entirely.
Right. And replacing it with the kind of generally characterized expansion that is consistent with the assumptions.
Are you happy with that?
I haven't proposed here a theory of scientific explanation. So I think it has something to do with the effectiveness of these methods across different kinds of systems, and their theoretical unity, the non-ad hoc nature. I would say the weakness of these assumptions, maybe weakness not is not the right word, but the fact that the assumptions are, I think of another word. The fact that the assumptions characterize the short time scale behavior of the model, and, I'm just repeating myself here. Mm-hmm. They're not heterogeneous. They don't come in from the outside. So something along those lines. Yeah. I might try to, when push comes to shove, I would want to stick to the deductivist part of DN.
and replace the premises with non-inconsistent ones. I really think we'll hold on to deductivism as long as we can. Yeah.
Mark Wilson is fond of quoting Oliver Heaviside when the logicality of his accounts came into question, and the logicality of his methods. Mark Wilson is saying logic can wait because logic is eternal. Now, I take it, though, that and I just wanted to get, I really, this is out of my depth, and I don't understand the details of this, but I'd just like to get clear on the general logic of your view, which I think is not to champion the use of methods that are inconsistent, but to suggest that there is I think the purport of what you're saying is that there's some considered methodology by which one avoids the inconsistency that Bob was observing, but it's not, and that strategy is in part an account of what makes the practice you're describing explanatory, but it's not. I think if you could focus on how begin with the situation where you have assumptions that allow secular terms, and then you want to modify those assumptions. And it isn't just a matter of I take it that the idea is that it isn't just a matter of plugging in something else, but there's a considered procedure by which you move from that initial.
Yeah.
And that's what you want. That's what you want to focus on. How that strategy operates in practice. How that changes effect.
Yeah. No, I think that's helpful. I mean, it's part of the kind of explanatory unification or global approach to explanation, where the explanatory merits of a derivation doesn't just have to do with the relation between the premises and the conclusion. It also has to do with how this fits into other explanations, or kind of the grander scheme, other kinds of derivations. So it's not just the deductive derivation itself, but as you say, I think this is right, and this is actually the process that you follow when you're trying to work out these problems, mm-hmm. is you start with a regular perturbation, you derive the secular terms, and you see the series exploding, blowing up, and then you move to a second method,
mm-hmm.
where you systematically eliminate the secular terms.
Mm-hmm. And presumably there's some kind of algorithm that there are algorithms that are well understood, that people follow.
Right. There's a couple of different heuristics, like these asymptotic methods that I mentioned briefly.
Mm-hmm.
Like introducing a new time variable, tau omega t, or multi-scale expansion, or
mm-hmm.
some averaging method. So there's a couple of heuristics, and these heuristics really are just incredibly, effective
mm-hmm.
in a broad range of these kinds of mm-hmm. nonlinear systems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To get, the second or third order, you get really accurate, you can derive really accurate descriptions of the behavior of the system that are uniformly valid over a long time period. So,
right.
these are heuristics that were developed in the last 50 years, I think, since mm-hmm. the Second World War primarily.
So, I mean, the effect of this isn't as in part of the question period, it seems to be suggested that the effectiveness of deriving a conclusion from inconsistent premises, but the effectiveness of moving away from an inconsistent starting point to one which was
right.
not.
Yeah, that's the key. Yeah, that's the key element. And I think, from what Steve said, it may be, a theory of explanation ought to clarify which bits are part of the derivation and which bits are part of the setup, the heuristic that gets you there.
Uh-huh.
And both are going to be part of, what makes this explanatory. Because if that heuristic didn't work, if it failed all the time, like there's lots of other heuristics that are going to fail most of the time, then you wouldn't, mm-hmm. It wouldn't be explanatory derivation. Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
I think that the idea of looking at the actual applications in physics and trying to learn from that for how we philosophers could inform our stories about what counts as explanation is really useful. And I think that the details of the difference between what you're exhibiting in these Pentone cases with Galilean explanations and the brief contrast you made with Bob's rainbow example, where in the rainbow example you have an inimitable appeal to the features that are handled in the theory to be reduced, as it were,
mm-hmm.
that are appealed to.
Yeah.
Now, I'm a little worried about your attempting to set up the lesson you're drawing as one that would exclude those while keeping something more like the Galilean ones. I think that that's sort of almost going backwards from the whole idea of we want to get our understanding by looking at the real cases and
right.
what are needed in the
yeah.
real cases.
Yeah.
And those are important real cases. And surely, I mean, one of the things I was struck by, Bob gave a talk at Michigan, and Larry was really pushing him on, Larry was suggesting that until you can do the whole thing in the fundamental theory,
right.
you don't really have an explanation yet.
Right.
And that's just wrong.
Yeah.
And I think it's a hard lesson for we philosophers of science to learn, but it's one that we ought to. Anyway, I'm a little worried about the
right.
fact that you're still too much sticking to
that. Okay. Yeah, that's. Yeah. Thank you for that. I didn't mean to exclude those kinds of explanations at all, or stick to base level explanation
okay.
exclusively at all. I mean, I went over it so quickly and it might have come out a bit wrong. You know, I'm happy for, you know, various degrees of explanation and heterogeneity amongst explanations. I mean, what I wanted to distinguish was to characterize a certain kind of what I call base level explanation from asymptotic explanation, which is not base level. It involves multiple levels. It involves, you know, what Bob has at one time characterized as the borderland theories. And there's no basis on which I want to exclude those as being just as explanatory. If anything, I mean, the goal here is to widen the scope of the role of idealization and explanation. So the fact that those idealizations are not, you know, representative or approximative or Galilean doesn't preclude them from being completely bona fide explanations. So maybe I just emphasize that point. They're a different kind of explanation because, for one thing, they're explanations at multiple levels or at some sort of hybrid level. And secondly, what they're trying to explain, and this varies, I think, maybe a bit from case to case, but from what I take it, the focus tends to be on explaining universality, on explaining the stability or the multiple realizability of these, you know, the critical exponent in all these different kinds of systems, right, which is different. So the explanandum is a bit different. But I certainly wouldn't want to exclude those in principle, and any account of explanation would include them. But I did express some, maybe a little, well, just because I don't understand the cases thoroughly enough, I would maybe just want to, I'd have to think about them more before I could kind of say that yes, those particular derivations are explanatory. I don't understand the use of the renormalization group enough to really make a judgment on that. Doreen?
At one point you talked about how you want to be careful not to reify the mathematics in ways that other people have. I worry though when you started talking about your intuition that the reason why this case is explanatory and not merely a derivation or predictive is that you can use the same types of methods in other cases.
Yeah.
That you're going in that direction. And maybe this is another kind of tension, that it's really important for your case that it's that you can, the approximation can be given in terms of the base level theory, right, entirely.
Right. Yeah.
So in these other cases where you can apply the same mathematical methods to nonlinear systems of other types, are you sure that you're only going to be using base level, the base level theory to do the approximation, or is it going to be sort of case by case matter where you're going to say, in some cases, you're going to be able to do everything at the base level.
Right.
In other cases, you're not. You're going to have to.
Yeah. I mean, there is kind of a variety of systems I'm familiar with where the base level characterization works, right? The approximate periodicity kind of characterization.
Okay. But it's not going to be enough just to say this mathematical method as a formalism.
Well, I didn't mean to characterize it as just a mathematical method. I mean, I emphasize that there's a bunch of different. I mean, at the level of the mathematics, there's a bunch of different approaches you can take
to
solving this, right?
Yeah.
It's more, maybe I'm not quite sure how to characterize this. I mean, it's more than a heuristic, but it's a kind of method that goes beyond the mathematics.
Okay, so if you look at one of the particular methods, like introducing the other time variable.
Right, like the multi-scale, independent, yeah.
Or multi-scale analysis.
Yeah.
So perhaps in some of those cases, if you characterize the method precisely enough, you're going to be able to say, in any case this works.
Right.
You can stick to base level descriptions.
Right.
And you
yeah.
don't have to invoke
yeah.
the higher level theory
right.
in order to do the approximation.
Right. I mean, you're pointing out rightly that to actually make this kind of case, you need to look kind of synoptically at all the different treatments of nonlinear systems, nonlinear periodic systems, let's say, if you wanted to scope it that way, and to look at the different kinds of methods and assumptions that are used. And then you could really make a strong claim. Oh, yeah, it's unified. We're using the same kinds of methods. We're using the same kinds of assumptions. Yeah, which I haven't done. Yeah.
So I was trying to understand what is the object of your explanation. So you've been focusing on the mathematical pendulum, just
yeah.
a simple linear device, and I was under the impression that you present an algorithm to predict or to mathematically formulate the long-term behavior of that device.
Yeah.
And that algorithm is based on some governing equation, which is subject to replacing it to limited it, and at the end of the day, you see how close you come to the empirical behavior.
Yeah.
I was wondering, how helpful is that mathematical algorithm to transfer the explanatory power or the predictive power from the case of that particular mathematical pendulum configuration to another more complicated configuration, which is still a mechanical system, like a double pendulum or a springs in between.
Right.
Because here, there's a distinction between trying to come close to the mathematical formulation of the behavior of one system, and on the other hand, what I'm implicitly asking for is the physical explanation of some underlying interactions which are in common for a particular system like the mathematical pendulum and any more complex device.
Okay.
So, did you address that issue at all?
So I think there's two issues there. I mean, one is whether the algorithm that I've sketched here is going to apply to a more complex device. Whether it's going to be the same algorithm or completely different algorithm or a related algorithm, is that the question? Because
the basis of your algorithm is a governing equation.
Yeah.
That you can
modify.
The type of physical explanations I have in mind is not so much focusing on any governing equations to begin with, but rather tries to explain where those equations themselves come from. So the equations of motions themselves are derived by looking which underlying interactions of motions give rise to them. And that whole issue I haven't seen being addressed here at all.
Okay. Yeah, no, I haven't addressed that issue of explanation of the governing equation itself and the relation of the governing equation to the physical target system.
So to me, that seems to be the essence of a physical explanation versus a mathematical procedure or an algorithm which comes close for one particular configuration only. So the generalization that I think is missing.
Right. So what you're characterizing as a physical explanation would be a relation between the actual instantiation of a physical pendulum, like a molecular description of a physical pendulum?
The subject of a physical explanation would be to identify and to physically determine the underlying physical interactions which lead to what you call governing equations and which one then can
limit
or not.
Yeah.
Well, here the governing equations and any ad hoc modifications to them just come out of the air.
Well, they don't come out of the air. I mean, I think this is part of Galileo's initial method. They come maybe in a somewhat abstract way, but it's not that you just pick out a new governing equation for every system in a kind of ad hoc way. It's a trial and error or a guesswork, kind of situation. But when you find, Galileo's success was that he found one governing equation which applied, saved all the phenomena, as Duhem put it. A law of free fall.
So if you look at the history, I felt much more comfortable by attributing the term explanation to the way how Newton first introduced the terminology of classical mechanics and then used it for the Leibniz governing equations.
Yeah.
And that's about missing those decades before.
Right. Okay. Okay. So these kinds of derivations you wouldn't want to call them explanatory.
At least not in the same way as we saw it in the Newton and the birth of classical mechanics.
Right. Okay.
It's an approximation algorithm, but it's not essentially a physical explanation which determines underlying mechanical interactions of motion.
Right. Okay. So one strategy would be to augment this kind of explanation with a physical explanation. I mean, there's a bunch of different ways you can go. You could say only the physical explanations, which start from the underlying, base-level physical description.
First principles.
Yeah, I'm not completely clear about exactly what those would look like. Only those are explanatory. Everything else is just derivation, just prediction or description. Yeah, you have that option. What I'm proposing here is somewhat different. Mm-hmm. I'm proposing that in cases where you don't have that physical description, but you have a kind of a pattern of derivation that works in a bunch of different contexts, mm-hmm. that those give you some understanding of the behavior and count as an explanation, admitting degrees of explanation. But in some cases, these kinds of derivations are explanatory, distinct from physical explanation. That's the idea.
I'm not sure that your characterization. I thought your point was fixing on the role of, say, the laws of motion, and then looking at fixing, the pendulum once you fix the physical description of the masses and the angles. So you've got an application of the laws of motion to a particular kind of system.
Exactly.
And that's what's giving you this damped oscillator equation.
Okay.
And it was that you were focusing on for the physical one, was getting the stuff
rather than,
so that's not what...
Right, okay. Thank
is
you.
That fair?
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay.
So it's a different basis from which one derives the behavior of a particular configuration.
Right.
Which, and from that more general basis,
fair enough,
can also apply to other configurations.
Yeah, okay.
And it's not an ad hoc case-by-case procedure.
Okay. Right, so this would only be part of the story.
Yes.
Part of the complete explanatory story.
Yeah. So the whole physical reason would come from the underlying way how we physically determine mechanical interactions. And then at a second level, it comes to apply common sense and justify why certain idealizations are possible, why parts of the configuration can be neglected compared to, say, the
Daddy
Mask, which is moving on. So here, every step would be physically justified.
Okay.
Rather than talk a bit, please.
Yeah, and that's missing from the portion I've described here. Yeah, fair enough.
I'll change the subject for a second. So, to your criticism of Alex Ruger, I think you're right to criticize him for, but I don't actually think what he's doing was reifying different time scales in some sense to get the different levels. I think really what he's trying to do is he has this picture that the way to think about these relationships follows from the way people think about it in the philosophy of mind. And we need to talk about levels and the way they talk about levels and various things like that. And he's trying to force basically the idea that there can be scale separation, right, into level talk. And I just think it doesn't work. Why adopt the sort of explanatory apparatus that sort of developed out of thin air in the philosophy of mind context, basically? In these examples, I think it's just a mistake, but I don't know whether the proper way to talk about it is that he was reifying the mathematics. I think he was just making some bad mapping attempts from one sort of language.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I read him as at least in part reifying the mathematics, and I think it was partly because he only had a multi-scale asymptotic method in mind, and only with two scales.
Right, I mean,
but the number of scales is not determined by features of the behavior. The number of scales is determined by the order of the expansion. If you have a three-order, if you go to epsilon cubed, you've got three time scales, or three scales, or whatever sort they are, right? So there's nothing essential about that, and then, of course, there's averaging methods, other methods, where you don't have any multi-scale expansion, which didn't, anyway. The effect was that it didn't make a lot of sense of what he was doing.
That's I agree with that.
So thank Andrew and have lunch.